talk about history. It's just pure catnip for me. Are you there?
Yeah,
we're here.
I think
okay.
Tim hit
I heard
the recording
it. I
button.
Suddenly heard this other voice on the phone.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure.
That's because we're recording it now. So.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to thank Dave for this opportunity. And as I started to say, the ability just to sit and talk about history at any time for me is just pure catnip. But I wanted to talk about the War of 1812, maybe from a slightly different perspective, because there's something that's been nagging me for many years and years. And it first came to light in my mind back when I was living in New York many years ago. And I was out having dinner with some friends on Greenwich Avenue. And we were all history buffs. And the subject of the War of 1812 came up. And I posed them a question. And I said, you know, why is it that we hear so little about that war? I mean, they call Korea the forgotten war, but in fact, Korea is very well known compared with the War of 1812. Why do you suppose that is? Well, they had different answers, but two of my friends had the exact same answer and in almost the exact same wording. And they said, well, we don't talk about that war because all we did was lose. And I've heard that throughout my life. Now, obviously, you know, as a statement of historical fact, that's wrong. That's extremely wrong. But that's the attitude that a lot of people have. And I began to think about that, and I began to wonder where they'd gotten that idea. Now, I can't speak for other people. I can only speak for myself. But in my case, it came from my teachers. It came from those series of social studies teachers I had beginning in the fifth grade in 1970, all the way up through 1979 when I was a sophomore in college and I had history professors. And there were variations, of course, but by and large, it was always the same narrative. And the narrative was, frankly, a rather dismissive one. Now, I don't want to, you know, this is not a hit piece on my teachers. I have great affection for these men in memory. And in fact, two of them I'm still in contact with over 50 years later. So I think they were good men and they were good teachers. But they were also the product of their times. This was the Vietnam War era. And a lot of them did not think much of America's military machine. And that had a kind of retroactive respect, you know, the way it functioned. I can't go into it now, but some of the statements they made about World War I and World War II, when I think back on them now, kind of make my head whirl. But, you know, they had this very jaundiced view of America's wars, and particularly the War of 1812. So what I would like to do is just kind of quickly just touch on their basic points as a way of going through the war very quickly, because we don't have time really to go into detail too much. The first assertion they made was that we had basically gone to war under false pretenses. Now, what they meant by that was that when Mr. Madison presented his war message to Congress in June 1812, he gave three reasons why he thought Congress should declare war on Britain. First was impressment. Right? The taking of our sailors off of American ships on the high seas. The second were the orders and council of 1807, which I'll get to in a second. And the third was all the mischief which Britain had been getting up to on the American frontiers. And this, of course, was very fresh in the minds of people sitting in Congress, because the previous November, when General William Henry Harrison had seized Prophetstown, the headquarters of Tecumseh and his Shawnee, they weren't there, at least a lot of them weren't there, but they burned the place, and what did they find? Box after box of British rifles. So they were very aware that England was up to no good beyond the Ohio River and beyond the Mississippi. My teachers didn't dwell too much on that point. They wanted to talk about impressment, but they did it in a very dismissive way. I remember several of them saying, oh, well, okay, it was a few thousand. I mean, maybe 2,000 or 3,000, maybe 4,000 or 5,000, but it was over many years. And you know, the French did the same thing to us from time to time. We didn't declare war on them. And, you know, it's really not the real reason we went to war. It's a smokescreen. I recently did a kind of tour of websites on the internet to see how impressment is being taught now to people. And I found it a very disheartening experience, because although of the 30 or 40 websites I looked at, some of them were okay, but a lot of them took that same line. Oh, it really wasn't much. One website, I'm really sorry to say, and this is from the National Archives, said something to the effect of, well, it was fewer than 10,000 men. And remember, these were being taken over a period of years from a country whose population ranged from 3.5 to 7.2 million. Well, that to me is an absolutely outrageous observation. It was never about numbers to begin with. It was about human dignity and national dignity. I mean, can you imagine in 1941 of Franklin Roosevelt on December 8th that said, well, you know, yesterday, you know, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, but, you know, we only lost 2,400 men out of a population of 133 million, so let's not worry about it. I mean, obviously, such a thing would be ridiculous. The generation of 1941 wasn't going to stand for certain things, and neither was the generation of 1812. Modern scholarship has pretty much established that between 1792, when the War of the First Coalition, right, this was revolutionary France versus most of the great powers of Europe, which saw the revolution as a threat to the existing order, headed by Great Britain. This, you know, once again, Britain's at war with France, which they'd been for every 15 or 20 years for, I think, the better part of the last millennium. Now they are back at war with France. And the Royal Navy, when it took to the seas in time of war, usually needed between 120 to 150,000 men, and they had a loss of about 10,000 men a year due to disease, desertion, and so forth. So they started grabbing the sailors off of our ships. It was nothing to be dismissive about. It was, in fact, human trafficking. It was terrorism on the high seas. And it's a crime that, because it seems to us so quaint and so far away, has lost a lot of its cruelty. You know, the whole nation has been riveted for the last 2 months over the disappearance of one little old lady in Arizona. Where did she go? Will we ever know? Well, imagine over the course of a year losing hundreds of men, husbands, fathers, sons, sweethearts, brothers, and in many cases never knowing whatever happened to them again. They went over the horizon and they never came back. Now, at the end of the War of 1812, the British did release a measly 1,500 sailors. It was meant as a gesture of, you know, good intentions. They did not take impressment off their books. An interesting tidbit is that that stayed a legal option on the British law books until the 20th century. Now, they didn't use it much after 1815, but still, it was always there if they needed it. Madison certainly understood this aspect of things because he talks about it in his war message, the kidnapping of our fellow citizens over the horizon to, you know, suffer God knows what kind of fate. Some of those sailors would have settled down in Britain. Some would have settled down in foreign ports. Some of them returned to America. Many of them died, and others just disappeared into the black hole of history. Now, my teacher suggested that impressment was in fact a smokescreen, because they argued that the real reason for the War of 1812 was it was a land grab, much like the Mexican War of a generation later. They felt that all you had to do was look at the letters and the diaries and the newspaper articles and the magazine articles that were constantly coming out of Democratic Republican papers calling for westward expansion to the north, to the west, to the south. The term manifest destiny hadn't been invented yet, but that's what they meant, you know, carrying out Mr. Jefferson's continental dream, pushing it all the way to the Pacific. And in a way, this has always amazed me, because just 9 years earlier, in 1803, thanks to the Louisiana Purchase, they had doubled the size of the country. They had more land to assimilate now than could be assimilated in 50 years. But land hunger is a drug. The more you have, the more you want. And, of course, they wanted Upper Canada, that region of British Canada, which lay above the Great Lakes. And on the other end of the frontier, they wanted British Florida. Florida had been in the hands of Spain since 1513, right? Ponce de Leon and all that. But in 1763, Spain had ceded Florida to Britain. And, in fact, during the American Revolution, we did launch several kind of small scale and abortive military operations from Georgia into Florida. And we never stopped, you know, trying to acquire it. Now, the power base of the Democratic Republican Party of Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison was the frontier. So their vision of a continental America and their sheer lust for land obviously had to be consulted. And as you all, I'm sure, know, the power base of their political opposition, the Federalists, was New England. And New England, even though it did suffer terribly from impressment, was willing to look the other way because they had been making so much money off of trade with Great Britain following Jay's Treaty of 1794, which had normalized relations. And now, once again, men in places like New York and Newport, right, and all those others, Boston, all the other ports up and down New England, are making money hand over fist from merchants who are shipping from places like Liverpool and Plymouth and Bristol and London. So they didn't want a war. That would dam up the river of profit pretty fast. Now, of all the assertions my teachers made, the assertion that the war was probably a lot more about getting land than it was about impressment, I think they were on more solid ground with that assertion than some of the others they made. However, as revisionists always do, they overcorrected the picture. Impressment was a serious reason for going to war, but they acted as if it was just nonsensical. It was just a pretext. Now, another assertion they made, and I didn't fully understand the history behind this until I got to college, was that we could have stopped the war when we had a chance about a month and a half into it. What they were talking about was, of course, the Orders in Council. In 1807, when Jefferson was still president, the Privy Council in London, His Majesty's Privy Council, had passed in January and then again in November a set of decrees which stated that British Royal Navy vessels could stop neutral shipping headed for French ports. By that time, of course, Britain had been at war against the French, first in the War of the First Coalition, then the War of the Second Coalition, and then since 1803 with Napoleon Bonaparte. That's 15 years of war. And Britain wasn't doing so well. They did magnificently on the high seas under Nelson, Battle of the Nile, Trafalgar, all that. But on land, right, at places like Ulm and Austerlitz, Napoleon had demonstrated he wasn't just another French general or Corsican. He was, in fact, probably one of the greatest military minds since Hannibal. And they were having problems. So they came up with this idea of using these orders and council to interfere with Napoleon's internal system of communication and trade, to hurt his economy and to make it much harder for him to communicate with his far-flung armies and supply them. We all know how Jefferson reacted to that in 1807. It was with the Act of Embargo, which boomeranged. It didn't work. It hurt the Americans more than it hurt the British. But what is lesser known is that the Orders in Council had a similar effect on British shipping and British merchants. Now, the Orders in Council of 1807 had been passed by two different prime ministers, Grenville and Portland. By 1809, Portland was gone, and there was a new prime minister who gets my vote as being probably the most unlikable prime minister in British history. His name was Spencer Perceval. And on the one side of the ledger, he was a dedicated abolitionist. But on the other side of the ledger, he was an ultra-Protestant bigot who hated above all things Catholics, the Irish, the French, Napoleon, and he wasn't very keen on America either. So when the English merchants came to him and begged him to withdraw the Orders in Council, he wouldn't do it. And it caused such a brouhaha that Parliament announced an inquiry. And it was while he was attending a late afternoon session of this inquiry and stepping into the lobby of the House of Commons on the afternoon of May 11, 1812, that Spencer Perceval achieved another distinction. He became the only prime minister in British history to be assassinated. A merchant named John Bellingham stepped up to him and pumped one right into his chest. Just by way of passing, I should mention that everyone thought Bellingham was as mad as a hatter. And they told him he could escape the noose if he pleaded to insanity, but he refused to do it, so they hanged him a week later. Justice moved swiftly in those days. So Spencer Perceval's gone. Lord Liverpool is now in. He's a much more tolerant kind of Tory, and he moves like grease lightning by British parliamentary standards. He gets into the prime ministry on June 8, 1812. On June 16th, he has the foreign secretary, Lord Castlereagh, announce that they're withdrawing the orders in council that had caused so much trouble with America and with their own merchants. And on June 23rd, they are in fact withdrawn, and everyone heaves a sigh of relief. Unfortunately, on the other side of the Atlantic, the American Congress had voted for war 5 days earlier. Now, the point that my teachers made was that when news of this reached Washington City, which it did 55 days later on August 12th, Madison had a chance to end the war right there. He should have just said, well, let's declare a ceasefire and begin negotiations. That sounds good from a distance. But when you get really down into the nitty-gritty of it, and it's this briar patch of, you know, communiques and crossed communications and mixed signals and all the rest of it, the fact was, as Madison pointed out in his State of the Union address in November of 1812, there was a problem. He couldn't possibly have declared the war over or even a ceasefire because the British refused to even discuss the main points of contention. Madison had made it clear that three things had to happen in order to avoid a war. First, stop impressment. You want to impress other ships? Fine. Of other nations? Terrific. But not Americans. Second, return the sailors you took. Third, withdraw the orders in council. Okay, the third one had been done. But the first two, the British stoutly refused to consider. Now, I think personally there was both a practical and a psychological reason why the British did this. The practical one is obviously they have a huge empire to maintain. The empire requires ships. The ships require sailors. They didn't know where they'd get the sailors if they stopped impressment, so they just carried on with it. The psychological point, though, that often gets overlooked is the British had the most profound contempt for America. I think there's this notion out there that when they got on their ships in 1783 and sailed out of New York Harbor and over the horizon, that was it, that they had given up all designs on America south of Canada. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. They understood the 13 colonies had proven tough nuts to crack, and now the 18 states, which were the United States in 1812, would be an even tougher nut to crack. But they were interested in those lands out beyond the Mississippi, and they had by no means given up in their ambitions about North America. They also had a great fear, which is if America ever pushed to the Pacific and became a continental nation with the resources that she would have at her command, she might well become the world's greatest superpower. And that was Britain's job, and they weren't going to relinquish it if they possibly could help it. So, there was no question that the British were not going to accede to Mr. Madison's demands. They had given up the orders in council. They had genuflected as far as they were going to go. You know, there's an interesting character named Augustus John Foster. He was the British ambassador to the United States in 1811. And he's a kind of case in point of the British attitude. Everybody loved this guy. They thought he was really genial and approachable for an Englishman. He was rumored to really like Americans. But he writes home to a friend of his in England, speaking of us, speaking of Americans. He says, "We forced them to become a nation when they were no more ready for it than the convicts of Botany Bay." And that really was the British attitude. We should never become a nation in the first place. But since we had, we weren't going to last very long. So there's no reason to change British policy in order to please the government of the United States. Under those circumstances, Madison could not have called the war off, even if he wanted to. It would have been a matter of national self-respect. You can't have the British tell you to go to hell on all these important points and then try to sign some kind of treaty. It wouldn't have worked. Now, the most contentious thing that my teachers said, and this harkens back to the beginning and my sitting there in that restaurant in New York years ago, all we did was lose. I think the reason why a lot of people feel that way, and again, I can't speak to other people's educational experiences, just to my own. My own teachers looking back, and I have a pretty good memory, I remember what they taught about the War of 1812. They basically avoided talking about our victories. They dwelt on the three disastrous attempts to invade Canada in 1812 and 1813. But they didn't talk about any of our, I'll tell you their greatest admission, which really staggers me. They never even mentioned the victory at Plattsburgh. I mean, that's a victory that, in many people's opinion, was the turning point of the whole war, second only to New Orleans as our greatest victory. And some people think it's even greater than New Orleans. And, you know, I can't go into detail now, it's going to be the subject of another talk. But the very fact that they wouldn't even mention Plattsburgh's incredible victory, right? Macdonough and Macomb over the British, it ended the last serious attempt by the British to invade New York State. And it was celebrated in song and story. You know, just a couple of months after the battle, right across the river here in Albany, at the Green Street Theater, they had a show called Backside Albany, The Battle of Plattsburgh. Which was a huge hit. I mean, people thrilled to the battle. And September the 11th was for them not a dark day in history, but for many years after was a golden date in the calendar. But I never heard about that from my teachers. I never heard about Oliver Hazard Perry's fantastic victory at Lake Erie. We have met the enemy and they are ours, right? I never heard of the great frigate battles. The Constitution versus the Guerriere and so forth, when those marvelous frigates that had been designed by Josiah Humphreys back in the 1790s to deal with the Barbary pirates, finally got loose against the British frigates, which were lighter and more poorly made. And in the six encounters we had in 1812 in the spring of 1813, we won six out of six. It staggered the British. They couldn't understand. They'd never suffered that kind of string of defeats at the hands of the French. And our string of victories wasn't broken until June 1813 in the tragic affair of the USS Chesapeake when HMS Shannon boarded her. James Lawrence, the young captain, is killed. His dying words are, "Don't give up the ship." And of course, that became the great battle cry which Perry took aboard the USS Lawrence, a brig named in honor of the dead captain, out onto Lake Erie. But I didn't hear anything about it. So what did they talk about? Well, they talked at great length about the failed campaign of William Hull out in Detroit, a man who by that time, although he had once been a great Revolutionary War hero, was a superannuated, seriously alcoholic commander who was basically falling to pieces. And I'm sure you know the story. Isaac Brock, the young, energetic British general, marches down the Michigan Territory toward Detroit, and General Hull simply falls apart. He cannot bear the thought of being overwhelmed by the Indians. He has a morbid fear of seeing his daughter and his grandchildren, whom he's foolishly brought with him to the fort, being tomahawked and massacred, and he just simply surrenders without firing a shot. According to tradition, he just waves a white tablecloth out the window to signal his surrender. And then, of course, there's the assault on Fort George on the Niagara River by the Army of the Center under Stephen Van Rensselaer. Van Rensselaer was a very clever politician and a brilliant man in many ways, the ninth patroon of Rensselaerwick. But he was not much of a soldier, and he'd been snookered into commanding the Army of the Center because Governor Daniel Tompkins, who was a Democratic Republican, Van Rensselaer was a Federalist, knew that Van Rensselaer was going to be running against him in the following year of 1813, and he and supposedly Madison and some of the other bigwigs of the party got their heads together and came up with a beautiful plot. Why don't we have William Eustis, the Secretary of War, appoint Van Rensselaer to head the attack on Fort George? And so You can't say no in a case like that. If you're a politician in 1812, you can't say, oh no, I'd love to go and help my country in time of war, but I have to plan my political program here in Albany. That wouldn't have flown. His career would have been over. So he does take command very reluctantly. And along with Alexander Smith, who's an Irish-born Virginian politician who hates Van Rensselaer's guts, as Van Rensselaer hates his, they march out to Fort George. And my teachers thought this was the most pathetic campaign they'd ever heard of. I remember one of them deriding it to saying, it needs Monty Python music. Well, it was a terrible story of bungling. The militia, as usual, was poorly trained, poorly equipped, and in this case, rather poorly led by the supreme commanders, at any rate. But even there, in the midst of that terrible defeat at Queenston Heights, on the 13th of October. The fact is, even there, you see the seeds of what the American army will become. They did get a few hundred regulars and militia across the swollen, turbulent Niagara River in boats, and those men proceeded to climb the almost perpendicular Queenston Heights and drive General Brock, the best the British had, off the hill. And not only drive him off the hill, when he launched a counterattack on foot, swinging his sword, they shot him through the heart and killed him. Then the Indians under Brock counterattacked, and the Americans faced a grisly choice. They could either surrender, they could fight and be butchered, or they could jump or fall from the heights. And unfortunately, many did. But they eventually make it back down to the beach where they surrender wholesale. Nevertheless, it's a story, perhaps it doesn't have a good ending, but it's still a story of bravery and self-sacrifice and dauntless courage. No Monty Python music there, I think. And finally, they told us about Henry Dearborn. I suppose I could hardly not, because East Greenbush has the Greenbush Cantonment, which was the area that Dearborn had bought from Stephen Van Rensselaer in May of 1812 to set up a training ground for the Army of the North. And here throughout the year 1812, he trained his 4,000 troops. I am sitting here on that land, even as we speak, on the land that was once the drilling ground of the Cantonment, and I've spent a good deal of my life living on it. I'm sorry to have to report that in the end, of course, the great attack on Montreal fizzled out. The militia simply were not up to it. They got into several stupid skirmishes. They fired into one another. It was eventually called off. The following year, Dearborn did, I think, justify himself somewhat better by attacking Fort George, and taking it, which was more than Van Rensselaer had been able to do. But having taken it, he couldn't hold on to it. He didn't finish off the British. Dearborn was always starting things he didn't finish. And the British came back and they took the fort, and a few months later, Madison relieved Dearborn of command. Now, if all I knew about the War of 1812 were those three fizzled campaigns, I can understand why I would go through the rest of my life thinking that, boy, that was one war that's better off being forgotten. However, my teachers did teach about one victory, but then, having taught us about it, they dropped a little bomb on us, the punchline. They talked about the Battle of New Orleans, and they talked about Jackson. Jackson nowadays is taught by a lot of teachers, so I'm told, as if he were just a racist, psychopathic murderer, kind of a Heinrich Himmler in a cocked hat. But at least my teachers acknowledged that he was a brave and gallant general, that he won this extraordinary battle against the odds. He had an army of less than 6,000, and he was able to defeat 8,000 men under General Pakenham, Wellington's brother-in-law, who had, this giant army he'd taken off the boats. But Pakenham launched a direct frontal assault, and as such, Jackson was able to stop him and in less than half an hour inflict some 2,000 casualties on the army, including killing Pakenham himself. And Jackson's total losses, 13 dead, 39 wounded. Even my teachers were impressed. They said, that was really a great one-sided victory. However, they then added, it was all for nothing. It was a pointless victory because it was fought on the 8th of January, 1815. And the Treaty of Ghent, the peace treaty that ended the war, had been signed in Ghent, in what we now call Belgium, then United Netherlands, on Christmas Eve, 1814. It had been over for 14 days or 13 days. And in fact, not only that, the treaty had been sent to London and the Prince Regent had signed it. So the war was over. And they treated this like it was, frankly, an amusing anecdote, like a kind of prank that the fates had played on General Jackson and his men. Of all the misconceptions about the war, that's the only one that really, frankly, makes me a little incensed. Whatever the Battle of New Orleans was, it was not a practical joke on Jackson. You know, again, we hearken back to what I said before. The great misunderstanding, I think, that a lot of Americans have about the period between 1783 and 1812 is this idea that the British had simply given up on their designs on America. And of course, that was the furthest thing from the truth. They were always scheming. British Army officers, tradesmen, secret agents, all the whole shady, strange bunch of people you found along the far frontiers were always trying to raise trouble among the Indians against us. And one of their firm convictions was if they could get ashore in large numbers on the west side of the Mississippi and seize that territory, then they could build invulnerable bulwarks, British colonies to the west, and also fulfill the now dead Tecumseh's dream of building one or two self-sustaining Indian nations, which actually did not represent one or two tribes, but a vast alliance. And with that, they thought they could pin America up against the Mississippi, keep it east of the Mississippi. And there's a marvelous historian named Ronald J. Drez who wrote a book about this several years ago. And I can't help but quote from a lovely phrase that's in the title of the book. He calls this an attempt to nullify the Louisiana Purchase. All right, so you have a document signed, 9 years earlier by Napoleon. So what? If you don't have your troops on that region, we're going to put our troops in there. And the thinking was that if Pakenham could get ashore and win New Orleans and seize the mouth of the Mississippi, we can start landing more troops and ever more troops. We can swing off to the left and start grabbing that territory that lies west of the river. And the proof of this lies in several points, which Drez talks about at length in his book. First, Pakenham was instructed that if you hear of a peace treaty, ignore it. Keep right on going. And second, they had secreted within his battalions large numbers of civil servants and administrators. Well, what were they there for? They were there so that once you grabbed the territory, you could get those colonial governments up and running as quickly as possible, and therefore confront the United States with a fait accompli. We already have this X number of acres, and we're going to grab these, How are you going to stop us? So when you consider that this was what was actually at stake, that Pakenham's attack was not some last half-hearted punch thrown by the British at the end of the war, but was in fact a full-bore invasion in an attempt, as Drez says, to overturn the Louisiana Purchase and seize that territory for Great Britain. You can only imagine how American history would have been different had Jackson won that supposedly useless, that supposedly useless battle. I assure you, had the British won it, they would not have regarded it as useless. I just want to say finally in conclusion that, as I said at the beginning, this is not a hit piece against my teachers. They were excellent teachers in many ways. I learned a lot of things from them. But when it came to America's past wars, and particularly the War of 1812, they were simply too cynical. Oscar Wilde has a character say in Lady Windermere's Fan, a cynic is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. My teachers were good men, but they were too cynical and they didn't understand the value of the War of 1812. And I want to thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Greg. Don't know if
Yes.
you can hear us.
There was a moment there when I thought, oh my God, they hung up 14 minutes ago.
No. You
I have.
have. Go ahead.
My ancestor, William A.G., was from Kentucky. They
Yes.
had him and his cohorts go down the river.